get you, Barbara.
Stop it.
How will we make it?
Maybe we should. Why don't we just...
What did you see, Clary? What did you see?
I like to remember things my own way.
Remember me.
Reasonably unhinged.
That is correct. We are finally back after a week of hiatus and with an absolutely packed studio. I'm so excited to talk about Charlie Varrick. I'm Heiner.
I'm Eddie.
I'm Sophia.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Rami.
And that's not all. We'll have some other folks joining us as the hour progresses. But for now, we'll just catch some first impressions about a landmark movie of the 70s that wasn't that big when it came out, but has had a lasting impact on Hollywood cinema, on crime, on the neo-noir genre, and on a lot of filmmakers, because it's Don Siegel. But we'll get into that later. Maybe first, let's get into the first impressions you had of the movie, Eddie. Do you want to start us off? What was your first impression of Charlie Varrick?
Well, I'm not that into like old movies, but I like the film. So even if I'm not that into old music, old films, old movies, I really like the film. It caught me. Like,
nice.
So
I think it speaks to the timelessness of just technical expertise that you were caught by this, because it is just has a lot of forward momentum. It picks its scenes very carefully, telling what to tell the audience.
And one thing I noticed is that the film doesn't have like blank spaces, mm-hmm. we can say.
Yeah,
like it's always progressing.
It's extremely functional.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So I liked it for those reasons.
Nice. Let's go around the horn. Sophia, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I liked watching it as well. I liked to watch Charlie, to see him think and what he was going to do next. And I liked that he always found a way to trick the others. And
always one step ahead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I really like that.
Nice. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, I liked the movie also because of the main character.
Mm-hmm. We have to mention Walter Matthau, one of the greats.
Yes, he has this charismatic and nice character,
mm-hmm.
and is so, I don't know, not so this, oh, I have muscles and I beat you down.
He also doesn't have a lot of bravado. He's a really kind of toned down persona for a leading man.
Yeah, he's this clever guy and patient and so.
Exactly. Rami,
yeah.
What about you?
Really interesting movie, I have to say. I'm a big fan of this noir.
Yeah, we have
style.
To mention you suggested the film for today.
Yes, yes.
How did you come to this decision? Was it just on one of those lists?
It was on one of those lists, I have to admit. But I think it was a good choice, I figured. It's a really stylish movie. I really like the way it tells the story, especially because the stakes are high from the beginning, which is really interesting. You have a lot of weird characters in the movie.
Yeah, for sure. That's another strength of the film. Kind of every character in the background, every person they interact with has some kind of quirk, some kind of oddity about them.
Definitely male-dominated and definitely a little bit outdated in some aspects.
For sure. Don Siegel is a... Yeah, he did Dirty Harry. He did a lot of...
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's this macho thing.
A lot of bravado.
Like you said, he's not muscles and everything. He's a lot of brain, actually, but he's still like, you know, this it doesn't talk much and
stoic.
Yeah, that's the word. Stoic hero or anti-hero, I don't know.
Mm.
But yeah, I liked it. The score was really beautiful. The camera work was really nice, and I think it is actually quite timeless. You know, it you can still watch it, and it comes to the it is not boring. Like, there's not a part where I had to say, okay, I have to endure this now to get to the next point. It's really interesting, well made. Yeah,
yeah,
that's
muscly filmmaking. Mm-hmm. It punches forward. And we have Flo joining us.
Hello.
Just now. We just went around the horn doing first impressions, so maybe join us with that.
Yeah, enjoyed it. Was, I'm not that flabbergasted, but was a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Good watch. Cannot add that much.
So you feel like solid
yeah,
work. Yeah,
solid work.
Yeah, it was completely in the pocket for me. I love this kind of movie that just takes you along a little journey of human indecency and bad behavior. Kind of almost every person we meet has a kind of angle or a little darkness, a little kind of bad behavior to them. There's no real like positive people. Even the weirdos in the background have some little quirks that aren't necessarily positive. And as Rami alluded to before, is full of this beautiful, beautiful music from Lalo Schifrin, who just completely, he's just the best. You know him from mainly the Mission Impossible score, but he's also done the fantastic Bullet score and the fantastic Dirty Harry score, which is kind of the film that reunites all these characters. I don't know if any one of you has seen the original Dirty Harry before. I think nobody. Okay, no. That's interesting.
Is it still worth it? I mean, it's
absolutely
one of those movies, right? It's on top of those lists of all time or whatever.
It is an evil movie. Like the sort of elements that are kind of rubbing you the wrong way with Charlie Varrick, they are all amplified to 10,000 in Dirty Harry. Like, the main guy is straight up an awful policeman, and the evil guy he's chasing is like the most disturbingly awful character, I think, in cinema history. He's called Scorpio. And he's actually the same actor who here plays Harmon, the sidekick of Charlie Varrick's, who also is a really unpleasant guy, I feel like, in the film. But it's nothing compared to Scorpio in Dirty Harry. He just is, yeah, the most disturbingly awful guy. And the guy who played the bank manager, the mafia guy, who's always got a smile on his face, he also has a prominent role in Dirty Harry. So it's almost like a reunion of sorts. And actually, Clint Eastwood was supposed to play the role of Charlie Varrick, but he decided against it because he had no redeeming qualities, is what Eastwood said. He didn't really want to play an asshole.
Which is funny. That is something that he comes from.
It's insane.
From his
because he also did Dirty Harry. And
not only that,
I would
one,
say
I mean,
he's
I mean,
much worse there.
What's the one, True Grit? No, that's not.
No, that's a Western.
Sorry. What's the one with the is it the Asian family?
Yeah, well, he did that like 20 years after.
Yeah, I know, but this is like
Gran Torino. You mean Gran Torino?
Yes. Yeah, I know. Made there are more movies with him, but he's this guy in every movie, in my opinion.
Yeah,
in a good way.
And he cites Don Siegel, the director of Charlie Varrick, as his main influence for filmmaking, which is an interesting aspect considering that Clint Eastwood, I think today, is probably one of the most influential, long-working directors of all time. He does this weird thing where he produces a movie within a couple of weeks and it's technically very proficient and very well done. But at the same time, you think like, maybe could have done one great one instead of five okay ones. But that's neither here nor there. But before we get lost in the weeds, let's get into the plot of Charlie Varrick, because it's really interesting the way we start off. We are thrown right into it with a TV montage of sorts. We get a weird little sort of collage of images, and we also get a little, a teaser for the end of Charlie or the end of the movie. And it makes sense considering that Don Siegel actually started his career as a montage maker, which I had never heard before, but was probably a sort of job that got you into directing roles back in the day. And yeah, with this sort of montage, with the wonderful Lalo Schifrin music just playing all over the place, going with 20 different instruments and high and low everywhere.
I found it interesting that whenever a new character came in the montage, there was a new like melody and the music shifted, and there was a different one for the little child and the donkey, and when the woman came, it was different again. And
yes.
Yeah.
It's fantastic, and it's so expressive, so loud in a sort of musical way. I loved it. And then we are right into the heat of it, because the inciting incident of this movie is a bank robbery. I love bank robberies. I don't know about you, but that's just movie gold for me. What are your thoughts on bank robberies and movies in general?
I'm a heist guy, definitely.
Yeah, me too.
It's a good way to start a movie. It's a good way to set up the theme or the topic of a thing. And I think they did it really well, because I've read like a small part of the synopsis. Not too much, because you know I still want to enjoy the movie. Mm-hmm. But I knew that, because I think it was the video I watched where this list where this movie was recommended. It told a little bit of the story, but then I skipped because I didn't want to spoil everything for myself. Mm-hmm. So I knew that it was about something happening with a bank robbery or whatsoever. But I liked the way that they set it up, you know, when they drove in front of the car, all the details with the cast on his leg. I mean, I don't know if you want to tell.
We'll get into it for sure. We start off with Charlie and his wife Nadine in a car. Charlie his get up is completely insane, because he has a disguise that makes him an old man, although he is already an old man. They just add color to it, namely gray. And he also has this wonderful fake cast on his leg, which has an added bonus of like a weird metal clamp that's down below his foot, so he just clops on the ground every time he walks. It makes it all so awkward and weird. And he clippity-clops into the bank and has some nice little smart touches to confuse the bank teller and the bank director. And then finally reveals that he's got two people in tow robbing the bank together with him. Meanwhile, his wife Nadine is in the car waiting for him, and the cops actually do their work and are very proficient. They put two and two together. There's a car missing or license plate missing, and they recognize the license plate that the bank robbers are using. And then comes the big shock, at least for me, because today I think you don't anticipate this kind of sharp move anymore. But Nadine, Charlie's wife, Nadine Varick, shoots a police officer point blank, just like starts the action off by immediately doing a homicide.
But I think it was obvious what is going to happen, and I was like, how is this cop not going to check? I mean, she's literally turning around and rummaging in her bag, searching for the fake papers and whatever. Mm-hmm. I thought this is going to be his end. Like,
I mean, it is a very concrete possibility, but it is also a stark choice.
Yeah, he didn't anticipate it because she was white, I think.
And a woman. Yeah, probably.
She was a white woman.
Yeah. But normally you would say, please step out of the car and whatever, you know, don't turn around, don't go into your bag and whatever. But he had it coming.
It's a rural area and it's the 70s. Yeah. So they were more chill there.
True that.
Even though it is like New Mexico, America, where apparently everyone has a gun. But at the same time, it is really shocking to me, because I see Walter Matthau and I think non-lethal solutions abound. Like, he is the the smart guy who has it all figured out. And this would be an escalation that would be a problem for him. So he has like five different options to circumvent this kind of violence. But nope. Fuck it. We're going all in from the start. They are cop killers and there's no going back after this bank robbery. And then they have to escape and they do this very proficiently as well. But before we go on with that, do you have anything to add to the bank robbery? Because it is such a central piece of the movie that sort of starts off everything that happens after it.
I think that... Well, I like, generally speaking, every type of movie that has things you have to plan. For example, robberies, prison breaks, things like that. It's my type of movie. So
it's extremely comforting.
Yeah, because when you have to plan something and then you have to like plan something around the things that... the like antagonists are doing.
Yes, something goes wrong, but then how much have they planned in advance for that to go wrong? And then what are the double floors that are breaking down there?
Yeah, I think it's perfect. It's the perfect scenario for a film. But in this case, it's a bit confused. Yeah. Like
confusing on purpose.
Confusing because it's the start. And you like get thrown into it instantly. So, yeah, it's a bit strange, but it's also lovely. the '70s, so you can't complain. Like,
I think it's actually wonderful, and it is because of the '70s that it was made in this way. Because Don Siegel, the director, didn't have as many constraints from outside. He didn't have sort of a general guide to adhere to. He just wanted to make the most proficient, functional movie out of what the script gave him. And it really paid off in my imagination because of so many factors. Maybe actually we'll just play you some Lalo Schifrin because I keep alluding to him and he is the big guy that to my mind makes this movie work all the more than it has to. So we're going to listen to Last of the Independents, the song from the soundtrack of Charlie Varrick and the slogan that Charlie Varrick himself puts on his jacket, his truck, and all of his memorabilia you can buy. Thank you. Just wonderful. Yeah, that's the mindset we are in this wonderful movie. And again, we have some outside noise. We just want some fresh air into this studio. So yeah,
too many people in here.
Please excuse us if there is some background noise. We are back and we are still talking about Charlie Varrick. And we just lost him escaping the police together with his wife, who has been shot in this extreme interaction. Do you have something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that it's amazing how good she was as a driver in this scene, even though she was shot.
Yes.
Like there was, I mean, I know
of course some suspension of disbelief,
but it was like, you know, the best driver I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's cool considering it's a very misogynistic movie to have Nadine as a really capable and
the perfect driver.
Yeah, really yeah. is. Yeah,
I mean, just, she's the only capable woman, but she gets shot in the beginning, so
yeah. That's so, I don't know if she's the only capable woman. We have the person who falsifies passports, and it is, I think, should suggested that she's very capable at her job.
Okay, but she gets
treated.
She gets treated way worse.
Of course.
So,
no spoiler.
Well, we get there, on we the get spoiler, there. Actually.
A great female movie, right?
There are no spoilers in the 70s movie, I guess.
No, we spoil every movie.
Yeah.
From the beginning to the end.
Yeah, we love
a great female character is also the secretary of the bank boss, bank CEO. I think
Miss Ford,
I think sometimes she's like but a good female character, not like Nadine or.
Yeah. I mean, I think Nadine is the only woman shown not having sex with any of the male protagonists.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what I wanted to say.
I mean, it's implied, probably, right?
But yeah, I mean, sure, she's married, but that's what I meant with she's the only.
She is not played for sexual attraction. Yeah,
she's not there for being sexual. She's there for her competence.
Yes,
and not anything else.
Yeah, and it makes it all the more tragic that Charlie just is the most cold-hearted bastard in the universe. Yeah. I mean, there is a lot of tenderness, and it is suggested that they have a very happy marriage and are in a very healthy, committed relationship to some degree. But at the same time, as she bleeds out in the car, and Harmon, Charlie Varrick's sidekick, and Charlie make the tough choice to just leave her behind, and not just leave her behind, but burn her in the remains of the car. It's a complete break from what we expect from a main character, I would say.
I'm not sure. I think he's characterized as like super rational.
Yes.
And I think,
but that's not main character material. Like, you can't really empathize with a guy that's so cold.
But I mean, she's dead, so he just makes the rational choice that it's better to just burn her remains with the car.
It is definitely so the practical move.
Makes a lot of sense.
But it is also the move that makes you think, okay, this is a bastard. I think it is a very harsh decision.
But still, he somehow, I always find it
the
interesting.
Tenderness.
Yeah, when the, I think you could call him an anti-hero.
Yeah.
When they manage to still make you empathize with them, because you still like Charlie.
Absolutely.
Like for all of the movie.
Yeah.
Even though he's so cold with his wife.
Yeah.
For example.
It's the, I think, the most central sort of cold move from him.
I wouldn't even consider it so cold, because at least he kisses her goodbye and everything.
But how does he do it? He kisses her one time, then he removes the wedding ring, puts it on himself. Those are very tender, beautiful kind of touches to emphasize this kind of intimate relationship. But then he pours black powder on him and then gives a second kiss and boom.
She's dead.
But it is a very stark decision to even pour it on her and go all in. It's tough. I thought it was tough.
I mean, it was kind of tough, but I think it just still makes a lot of sense in the situation. And
he's just looking out for his own well-being, for sure. But it could also be played for, you just lost your partner in crime, your person that's means the world to you. You are just shell-shocked, or you're just not able to proceed.
Yeah,
I have
but
a question. Yeah. In the next scene, he is throw away his pistols, and so would you think this is because his woman died with shootings? So.
Nah, I don't
or
think
is
so.
It just
okay. It's just practical. That's the way to get rid of it, just in case they were being stopped. And it's just, again, rational Charlie being rational.
Okay.
It was just my reading of it. You could also, that's like a really heightened reading of it to be like he, but it would also sort of destroy his image as the cold calculating guy to be, this is kind of an emotional move to say like, my wife was killed by handguns. I am now anti-handgun.
Yeah, I think if you want to read it like that, you can just go one step further and be like, it feels like this is his breakup with crime because he made enough money, he lost his wife in a crime, and then he just throws away the guns and everything and says, okay, let's settle down. From here on, I don't want this life anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's also playing into it. But in a very calculating, rational manner. He's not about to give up the money, about to get himself caught easily. He's still looking out for number one, but he has more on his mind after
also
this.
Also, the gun throwing away scene made me a bit laugh because it was like, back in the 70s, this would have worked. Just throw your guns in some kind of water.
Why not? I think it would work today.
No, I don't
Who
think it would work.
Who looks into a fucking pond or into a little like bubbling
today,
brook?
I don't know. I think today the cops would find these weapons.
Well, here in Germany, where you have like 20 streets, but like New Mexico in the middle of nowhere, who would triangulate this location?
The thing is, I mean, they met a cop at this certain point, so maybe that cop could remember him, especially because there were sketches afterwards in the newspaper, so I think it's not...
So you would expect the cops to start looking into every river in the vicinity?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be the most obvious thing in this moment, at least to look at the close vicinity, the area that they met in?
For sure.
I mean, it would be a thing you could do, but in the end...
Get divers for it.
Yeah, probably it's not even that deep, you know, it's just a small
room. They wouldn't get their feet dirty.
Yeah, I think it's because maybe they wouldn't have searched for the guns, because if they got away with the money, how did they not like hide the guns? Like probably they wouldn't have thought that Charlie and the other one like have thrown the guns in the river.
Mm.
So
I think every major city in the US, if you go to a bridge and jump from it and dive down, you find like 20 handguns.
Probably. You don't even need papers, right? Do you need papers to own a gun? I mean, you can just buy them.
I think it's state by state.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
So,
but I think New Mexico is probably a very lax state in those terms. So you can probably go to any Walmart and say like, I'm over 18, give me 20 shotguns. It's not a problem.
One of the shops that we see in the movie too is like a gun shop, and I don't think it has license or things like
that. I mean not in the 70s, I'm just talking about nowadays.
Also now,
I think back in the days, I think it was even more lax to say the least,
depending on the state. Let's just get to some more weird fun characters, because we have so many odd folks in the background. You just mentioned a gun salesman who is sort of a underground figure connecting Charlie to a prospective fake passport creation. And he's in a wheelchair and he's a real weirdo. And he has this little shop and it's just full of quotes. He just goes all in saying weird shit all the time. And he also, who is putting the trail on Charlie? Because as it turns out, as they return to the trailer park, where we have find another wonderful character in this movie, also arguably a person, no, No, it's not true. Anyway, in this trailer park, Charlie lives with Nadine, and they return to the trailer park and find an old woman who seems to be there a long time, seems to have an established relationship with Charlie.
I would say this is the second woman.
That's what I was about to say, but then I took myself back because I think she sexualizes herself very much. She is constantly going like, oh, everyone's a pervert, and at the same time going like, I'm kind of into pervert stuff. And there's one little scene where she's in the middle of the night going like, yeah, basically have sex with me, anyone. I don't know if you recall this. It's a really short little weird thing, but she just runs around in the garden and says some weird stuff.
I just remember that. I just remember that when she first talks with Charlie, they are like talking and she says, don't get any ideas like that. Yes, so exactly. If you think
she is always going like
sexualizing him.
Please don't get any wrong ideas and always brings sex into the conversation as a scandalized sort of point of view.
It's weird. I didn't have that impression at all.
Really?
From her,
that's interesting. Well, she was just kooky to
me
you.
Neither,
yeah,
but
it's just a bit weird and bit nosy and knew always everything that was going on.
Yeah, yes. It's not it's sexualizing.
No, but she was flirtatious, definitely.
Yeah, flirtatious. Mm-hmm. And she also really explicitly... Yeah, there's again this weird little moment in the garden, but also the milkman, her allusions to the milkman being constantly horny for her, and this being the reason that she doesn't welcome the milkman anymore. He has to put the stuff on the stoop because she feels so sexualized by him. And we even have a callback to this moment when later on in the movie she picks up her yogurt and her milk from the stoop because the milkman put it there. But she is sort of the color to the living conditions of Charlie. Charlie seems to be a very down-to-earth man. He seems to have put all his money into his crop dusting business. And crop dusting is a real weird and interesting thing. I have a sort of an agrarian background, which is why I find this doubly interesting. But it's something that here in Europe, especially in Germany, has been outlawed for a long time. The EU has put a ban on it, the praxis of taking a plane and just basically blasting chemicals from up high down to all the area, ideally hitting the fields, but oftentimes hitting a lot of other people in the process and creating a lot of really bad health scares and health crises.
I mean, it's
in
something
America.
Americans are good with, right?
Yes.
To throw stuff out of planes.
Yes, and in this case, it's the rare instance where it hits their own citizens instead of other citizens, and therefore, is still being used much less than it was back in the day. I think it was a completely normal practice in America, which makes sense considering their fields are like 100 times larger than ours here in Europe. But at the same time, of course, you can't control where this aerosol poison goes. And it oftentimes hits the rural communities who then for decades have different health issues or just die straight up. There have been a lot of lawsuits about it. But at the same time, it's such a cinematic thing to have this little biplane, this little rickety thing in the air, which seems to almost crash on purpose. Anytime you see it in the air, you just feel like it's not supposed to be there. And then having it spray poison as a just normal, everyday agrarian task. And that's Charlie's fallback because he used to be a barnstormer. Another weird term that even I hadn't really connected to this its real meaning before, but it was the weird flying circus thing where people who were very proficient flyers would do flying shows, basically fly in breakneck pace and do weird stunts, and meanwhile they have another guy on the wing doing weird stuff too. and all of them basically almost killing themselves. And it was very popular in the 20s and then had a slow decline in the decades after that. And that adds to Charlie's sadness, I feel like, that this was probably his true calling, the thing that he loved most to do with Nadine together. They used to be together in one of those flying circuses. He did a drunk act, which sort of against character to have such an outgoing kind of character playing him. But at the same time, it sort of makes sense. And yeah, this wistfulness that we see in Charlie, I think it is sort of transported to this. Yeah, his career is gone and he has no sort of recourse to do what he loves because nobody would pay him for it anymore.
That's why you turn to crime.
Yes.
Probably.
Exactly.
The adrenaline.
He is the last of the independents, as he labels himself. And there's a real sense of lost time, lost, lost self-esteem, lost agenda, I felt.
Yeah, it's similar like to I think, the last days of the Wild West, you know, when everything was beginning to be more civilized and people started to were like clinging to these old days because this was the only thing they knew, the only reality, and suddenly everything changed.
It's also Don Siegel's thing. He's a real, like, I don't want to say Republican, but like he has a real black and white he often portrays a very weird black and white kind of view of the world and reinforces it with characters that exhibit a really dark view of everyday society. Everyone's kind of not really on board to adhere to social norms, and anything can break down at any second because we are just beasts.
I mean, he did the OG Body Snatchers movie.
Yes, which is kind of his mission statement for being kind of having a really negative view on how society progresses. But that's neither here nor there. We are still middle of Charlie Varrick, and there's a lot to still get to because Charlie has some moves. Charlie is not content with having this little fuck up and the loss of his love derailing him. He still has to handle Harmon, his sidekick, who is just awful, just the most nerving. He gets on my nerves so much. I don't know how you sort of clocked Harmon's behavior.
Same. I think it's tough because in this field of profession, you cannot really choose who you're working with, right? So I think it's there's a lot of compromising between those two because he's just like hot-headed,
he's completely cold, like cold fish.
Yeah. He cannot wait. Like I found it really funny when Charlie was telling him okay to lay low for the next 3 to 4 years before touching any of the money.
Yeah,
and he was like, "No, I'm going to spend it on all of this stuff."
Yeah,
which is like, "Damn, bro, that's not even that long." And you're
he's
young.
So dumb. Like he doesn't get it that he can just be like, "Yeah, Charlie, I'm going to do that."
Maybe we have to say that it was much more money than they anticipated.
Yes. That's the big twist.
And also, can I?
Yes.
Okay.
Go all in.
Because this was a really nice revelation when they actually broadcasted about the robbery, and then the bank clerk or the people were saying that they were missing about $2,000 or something like this.
Yes.
Which in fact was about, I don't know what it was, 700,000, 800?
750,000, so 760,000 to be exact.
Which is fishy if you think about it.
Yes, especially considering it's a 70, so that's like 10 million bucks or something.
Yeah.
And we are sort of alluded or being given a little hint to it in the bank robbery where the bank manager is urged to open the vault and he is sort of hesitant, which first, of course, makes sense. He's like in a life or death situation. But then he has this weird big, like a bag of sorts. And it has a special mechanism where you remove like a metal pin from it to open it, and he's even more hesitant in giving that up, and it's being described as having bonds, a sort of like security version of money, which I think was the intention of the bank manager to say, like, this is not interesting for you guys. It's not going to get you anywhere, so just leave it here maybe. And they take it anyway, and of course that's where the big payload is. And as it turns out, it's coming from Reno Mafia. Are you familiar with Reno? Because up to this point, we are in Albuquerque, we are in New Mexico. People probably know it from Breaking Bad and many other films, thanks to its really Western sort of barren wasteland atmosphere. It's been used in movies a lot of times. But Reno is a different thing. It's also been used in movies a lot to suggest a sort of, really bad environment.
Yeah, but, like dodgy.
Yeah.
Like,
have you heard of Reno before as a concept?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. You guys? No.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
No.
It is a sort of discount Las Vegas. It's also in Nevada, so the same rules apply as they do in Las Vegas. You can do gambling, you can prostitution is sort of allowed in the state, or like, yeah, it like a weird, yeah.
I mean, it's Native American territory, right? That's the reason.
No.
Isn't it? I thought no. Because Las Vegas
you can have on Native American territory a gambling in any state in America. Okay.
But I thought
only
it's also
in Nevada can you do it.
But where does this stem from?
Just states having their own decision-making
really?
Freedom and this being a weird desert state that didn't have anything going for it and just having gambling alone
I thought by history that this was still like just considered to be Native American ground and they sold it, but still like
might
the,
be. I don't know. There might be the origins of it, but at this point, Nevada is just this unique case where the laws are very different from the rest of the U.S. You can also get married very quickly there. That's also a known fact that comes into play in a lot of movies, that you can go to Nevada, Las Vegas or Reno and get married right away, and it'll be the legal binding marriage contract. Anyway, Reno spells just sleaziness and darkness, and that's exactly what happens when we find out that right there in Reno is the base of operations of our mafia, the mob. What else do they call it in this film? They have like many different variations of calling it the mafia. But we find out that actually this mafia has its paws in the whole banking sector in this little part of the state, because the bank that's being robbed by Charlie Varrick turns out to be a debt drop for the money that this mafia group is laundering, and even the bank manager is involved in it. And I think this is a very early instance of this kind of criminal who just wants a normal life and then just is being thrown into chaos and just can't handle it. I don't see it very often in early movies, and I think in TV shows these days it's a very popular thing to make an empathetic character who is very connected to crime. The TV shows like Ozark and Breaking Bad and stuff like that, to have your cake and eat it too. How did you take this in, this part of the movie? Any thoughts?
I liked it a lot. I think it's a really, really interesting way of setting up this whole thing, you know, explaining why there was this much money and why it was this small little city that nobody cared about. And I also like the, you were talking about this Maynard guy, right? Maynard Boyle?
Yes.
Yeah.
He is also part of the reunion of Dirty Harry. He is a Don Siegel repertory actor who shows up in a lot of his films.
No, I liked him because
his smile, right?
Yeah, but then again, there were a lot of scenes where he was flabbergasted, you know, where he was like,
this Charlie Varrick guy.
Confronted with the reality. Yeah, true that. And especially this other guy that we haven't talked about.
Yes.
Molly.
Go for him.
Yeah.
I love Joe Don Baker. He's a guy who shows up in
films. The role is amazing. He's just the biggest asshole ever.
Yes.
And he's so how to say, he knows it, right?
He enjoys being evil.
He likes it a lot.
Yes.
And he just goes through life with this kind of motivation or self-awareness.
Yes.
He's like the... What is his? He's just the muscles, right? This is like the guy who goes around and
he's
collects.
A fixer.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's being called by any mafia, by any sort of crime organization if something goes wrong and someone has like to be killed or something has to be retrieved.
Yeah. And I think he does it in a really good way. And one thing I've realized just now that there are so many similarities to like Fargo and all of those kind of movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously they came later, but there's so much inspiration from like characters and of course those are roles that are common within the mafia structures and stuff like this, but just how...
No, but at this point Don Siegel was doing a lot of the pioneer work for this kind of
you see that neo-noir. Also the way of telling three or four different stories at the same time and switching places and how they intertwine with each other is really, really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like clockwork, really. Yeah.
I think there are, I think it's two main scenes when Molly gets introduced, where Don Siegel definitely wants to show you how much of an asshole he is, besides constantly smoking his pipe,
and really
putting it out on everything.
Yeah,
he doesn't respect anything,
especially not any property.
Yeah, when he goes getting the car, and he goes with the Asian guy from the casino.
Yes,
and he just. There's this car in a lot, and the current owner or current inhabitor of it gets there, and he just punches this black guy in the face and just like, no, this is my car now. and the scene with the woman with the photographer who does the fake passports for Charlie, when he just... I think this was the weirdest scene in the movie for me.
Yeah.
This kind of rapey thing.
Yeah.
Because he just goes with her.
Yes.
They stand in front of each other. He just hits her, slaps her in the face.
Yes. And of course she likes it.
Yeah. And apparently she likes it. And they just close the door, implying that they now have sex. And it was like, I was like, what the fuck?
It fits very well into Don Siegel's view of the world. Like, everyone's fucked up, everyone's corrupted, and you just
expect don't have a choice.
One reaction, and then the other reaction happens, which is even darker.
The prostitution thing also was like really weird to watch.
Yes.
Yeah. So I have something interesting about that, because I watched another film. I don't know if you know it. It's called Love Ranch. It's from 2010 or something, and it's about the first legal brothel in the States, and I think it's the same one, because the madam who manages the one in this movie, I think someone calls her Miss Conforte, and that's the
Cornfalls? No.
Conforte. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but yeah, she was. Actually, the one who was the first woman who had the first legal brothel.
The actress in the movie.
Not the actress, but the...
The name she is being called.
Yeah.
Ah, that's interesting.
So it's based on a real woman.
Because I felt like it's also a really weird brothel, because there aren't many clients, but there are like 20 or 25 women all standing at the ready.
It felt more like some sort of... They have a motel or something as disguise, and then they just work there because he sleeps there, he stays there overnight in this room, and they the sin bin, yeah, that great thing. And he gets offered a sex worker, but he just declines in a very rude manner.
Which just makes so much sense for the character.
Sense.
Nah, I like to be evil. Leave me alone. I have no time for this. I have to be evil.
I mean, things
his,
to do.
Yeah, his quote is, I don't sleep with whores, not knowingly. Which is like, what the fuck, guy?
Really not surprising.
And then he just goes and rapes a woman.
Yeah, considering his outlook on life, it's not that surprising. But the whole environment there is fascinating, and the madam of the brothel is also a real presence. Like, she, you get the sense that she has had to interact with these kind of sadistic evil men all her life, and she just knows exactly what to do, while the younger sex worker, who is sort of her protege, is really set aback by his just awful behavior. Yeah, but that's just one of the weird places we visit. We also have a return to the bank where we are sort of more let into this also kind of tender relationship between the head of the bank and the bank manager in this little town. They seem to have a friendship and they seem to have been like, yeah, we do this illegal thing, but we're just guys doing our thing. And it's just like, oh, now we have this problem. And yeah, it's a very frank discussion of like, I'm not made to be in jail anymore. I'm not just really able to cope with this situation, which ends in his suicide, which is another interesting sort of decision on the film's part. It's completely unnecessary for the central plot, but it adds a lot of character and a lot of color to the film that this character is just given so much presence in the film. This weaselly sort of, yeah, just sort of scion of a criminal family who really just wants the benefits and then has established a real small town life in New Mexico. And then his crime background finally catches up to him and he's completely unable to cope with this change. But this not all. I don't know if you have any more highlights you want to get to. We are in the last 10 minutes of our hour, and I don't want to take anything away from your thoughts.
I think we should go on throw more to the showdown thing that's happening.
Let's go.
The only thing on the way there is like then how Charlie Varrick gets to contact the mob when he, as we mentioned, there's the secretary.
Yes.
A character when then he just sleeps with her because he never slept in a round bed. It was also like a very weird line. He just says, I never slept in a round bed. And she says, yeah, maybe you do tonight or something like
no,
that.
No, no. It's a really fun bit of writing.
Yeah. But
they are going
weird.
North to south. And then they even coined this phrase, which then was used in the US.
South by Southwest?
No. Before that, the necking the compass all around or something like that. I actually
but where does the South by Southwest come from?
Hitchcock movie?
No, but that's North by Northwest.
The South by Southwest is the last configuration they were missing. Basically, the turn of phrase was, I'm paraphrasing, she says like something innocuous and he does the sexual innuendo of, I want to knock you around the compass. And then he apparently has ticked off all the configurations of the compass except for South by Southwest.
Oh, yeah, in a way, I thought it's the Hitchcock movie, it's the movie festival, South by Southwest. that's a festival.
Yeah. I mean, it's an illusion to that.
I don't know.
And not the location of Austin where the festival is playing within the United States. Well, who knows?
Okay. There's the big showdown.
What I had in mind was boxing the compass.
Oh.
He wants to box the compass.
And what does
very
it mean?
Sex.
It's sex in every position on the compass, on the round bed.
Boxing. Okay, yeah.
I don't know, man. It's just actually a phrase
in
English.
Yeah.
And this is sort of the preceding moment, the final pieces of the puzzle or of the chessboard that Charlie sets up for his grand finale, his grand coming together of all the threats he's been laying in the meantime, when he sets up a meet between the head of the bank and himself in an airfield area, middle of nowhere. As you alluded to, he went to Reno in advance and sort of, did a really smart thing by just leaving them in New Mexico and doing some more threat pulling in the actual home base of the mafia. And then they finally meet on an airfield, and the first double cross he makes is embrace the bank manager while he knows that Molly, our
hitman is somewhere watching. And he goes like, yes, we finally pulled it off. Come on, let's embrace. We can celebrate finally. And Molly, of course, immediately sees red and books it, just hits another car on his way there, is just completely out of control and tries to run over both of them. Charlie escapes and the bank manager gets it. And then we are off to the races with our final sort of heist moment, I would say, or like chase moment.
I think it's really interesting choice to let him drive a plane on the ground. And I actually was wondering like how long this scene is going to be, because it took so much time of the clock, in my opinion.
For sure.
I mean, it was intense, but it was really long.
Yeah, if you are gonna do a real like flying stunt, I think you want to milk it as much as possible, because it was probably very technically challenging to pull off, and also very dangerous. The actual plane that was used there killed its next driver and was crashed, which was a very common occurrence back in those days.
It's crazy. But it was very intense. I really much enjoyed it. The whole chase scene.
Yes.
Even though I sat there and was like, yeah, come just pull up, just fly away.
Yes,
just try exactly. And fly away.
Johnny. But no, he has some more tricks up his sleeve.
Yeah, he has like the most elaborate plan.
It's crazy.
When there's a chase, they chase each other around on this airfield, and then I was very flabbergasted because he was sometime, and then out of nowhere, Charlie just puts a stick in front and flips over the plane. And crashes it.
That was really the one moment where I was like, okay, did you really have to do that? Come on.
No, I was like, what the fuck? Did you just slip and try to kill yourself? But no, of course not. Charlie Varick has a plan, as always. And yeah, he's like approached by Molly and asked for the money. Charlie knows he will betray him and just planted a car bomb there. A classic... As the camera shot,
I think that's actually the least likely, that his timing was so picture perfect that it's like on the second he like opens the thing, the thing explodes.
I mean, he stood there for a few seconds and just stared at it. But yeah, okay. Charlie instrumented a car bomb and installed their car bomb and even placed the body of his friend.
Yeah, that's
friend,
sort of a long-running thing, because we know he exchanged the dental records of his with those of his sidekick. And we've got the dead sidekick just hanging out in the trailer for a long time. And we're just waiting for it to come back.
I think
finally it pays off.
It wasn't even that long time, because I think there was just one night.
Yeah.
It was the whole plot is like
very
2 short, days or 3 days.
Yeah.
So it's not, it feels longer than it is in actual time. And then, he blows up Molly, and then you see that he has the money. He's set on the money,
fantastic.
Basically. In the, and it, yeah, it's
Molly
really great.
Molly flies away, and he's like on the back of a upside-down car, just like completely tangled with wires. It's, just very gruesome.
And Charlie just let herself fall out of the plane, and under him, two plastic bags full of
cash. And to make it even more believable, he throws some bonus cash on the flying on the burning pile to suggest.
I thought this was a very nice touch.
Yeah, all of those are nice touches. It's a really well constructed script. And with that, we are entering our last minute. I have two quick fun facts. One is that Lalo Schifrin is actually sort of putting together his score with themes in mind, and he had one instrument that he directly connected to Walter Matthau, the droopy dog leading man who plays Charlie Varick, and I'm going to play a little bit for you there. It's basically a huge xylophone, and I think this sort of low sound fits very well. And then finally, Walter Matthau did not like this movie. He hated it. He actually hurt its performance by saying publicly, I don't like that, don't go to it. And he told Siegel, I have seen it 3 times and I'm of slightly better than average intelligence, in brackets IQ 120, but I still don't quite understand what's going on.
I read that as well. I loved it.
What's going on? Is there a device we can use to explain to people what they're seeing?
Anyway, and with that, our time is up. Thank you all so much for being here. And we'll see you next time. Bye.
Bye-bye.
See you. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.